Chapter 20. Hetton House included a large parcel of land in back of the main buildings, and here was planted what generations of boys had come to call the Victory Garden. The headmistress before Coslaw went slack on it, telling people she had a brown thumb rather than a green one, but Martin, the law Coslaw, saw at least two shining potentialities in the Victory Garden. The first was to make a substantial saving in H.H.'s food budget by having the boys grow their own vegetables. The second was to acquaint the boys with good hard work, which was the foundation of the world. Work and mathematics built the pyramids, Coslaw liked to say. And so the boys planted in the spring, weeded in the summer, unless they were working out on one of the neighboring farms, and harvested in the fall. About 14 months after the end of what Toe Jam called the Fabulous Blueberry Summer, John Chelsman was among the pumpkin-picking crew at the north end of the VG. He took a cold, sickened, and died. It happened just that fast. He was packed off to Portland City Hospital on Halloween, while the rest of the boys were at their classes or away schools. He died in City Hospital's charity ward, and he did it alone. His bed at HH was stripped, then remade. Blaze spent most of one afternoon sitting on his own bed and looking at John's. The long sleeping room, which they called the Ram, was empty. The others had gone to Johnny's funeral. For most, it was their first funeral, and they were quite excited about it. Johnny's bed frightened and fascinated Blaze. The jar of Shed's peanut butter that had always been stuffed down between the head of the bed and the wall was gone. He'd looked. So were the Ritz crackers. After lights out, Johnny often said, "Everything tastes better when it shits on a Ritz," which never failed to crack Blaze up. The bed itself was made up in stark army fashion, the top blanket pulled taut. The sheets were perfectly white and clean, even though Johnny had been an enthusiastic lights-out masturbator. Many nights Blaze lay in his own bed, looking up into the dark and listening to the soft creak of the springs as J.C. flogged his doggie. There were always stiff yellow places on his sheets. Christ, those stiff yellow places were on the sheets of all the bigger boys. They were on his own right now, beneath him, as he sat on his bed, looking at Johnny's bed. It came to him like a revelation that if he died, his bed would be stripped and his cum-stained sheets would be replaced with sheets like the ones that were on Johnny's now, sheets that were perfectly white and clean, sheets without a single mark on them to say someone lay there, dreamed there, was lively enough to squirt off there. Blaze began to cry silently. It was a cloudless afternoon in early November, and the Ram was flooded with impartial light. Squares of sun and the shadow crosses of muntings lay on J.C.'s cot. After a while, Blaze got up and tore the blanket from the bed where his pal had slept. He threw the pillow the length of the Ram. Then he stripped off the sheets and pushed the mattress on the floor. It still wasn't enough, so he kicked one of the jutting bed legs and succeeded in nothing more than hurting his foot. After that, he lay on his bed with his hands over his eyes and his chest heaving. When the funeral was over, the other boys mostly left Blaze alone. No one asked him about the overturned bed, but Toe did a funny thing. He took one of Blaze's hands and kissed it. That was a funny thing, all right. Blaze thought about it for years. Not all the time, but every now and then. 5 o'clock came. It was free time for the boys, and most of them were out in the yard, goofing around and working up an appetite for supper. Blaze went to Martin Coslaw's office. The law was sitting behind his desk. He had changed into his slippers and was rocked back in his chair, reading the Evening Express. He looked up and said, "What?" "Here, you son of a bitch," Blaze said, and beat him unconscious. He set off walking for the New Hampshire border because he thought he would be picked up inside of 4 hours driving a hot car. Instead, he was collared in 2 hours. He was always forgetting how large he was, but Martin Coslaw didn't forget, and it didn't take the Maine State Police long to locate a 6'7" male Caucasian youth with a bashed-in forehead. There was a short trial in Cumberland County District Court. Martin Coslaw appeared with one arm in a sling and a huge white head bandage that dipped to cover one eye. He walked to the stand on crutches. The prosecutor asked him how tall he was. Coslaw responded that he was 5'6". The prosecutor asked how much he weighed. Coslaw said that he weighed 160 pounds. The prosecutor asked Coslaw if he had done anything to provoke, tease, or unjustly punish the defendant, Clayton Blaisdell Jr. Coslaw said he did not. The prosecutor then yielded the witness to Blaze's attorney, a cool drink of lemonade fresh out of law school. The cool drink of lemonade asked a number of furious, obscure questions, which Coslaw answered calmly, while his cast, crutches, and head bandage continued their own testimony. When the cool drink of lemonade said he had no further questions, the state rested its case. Blaze's court-appointed called him to the stand and asked why he had beaten up the headmaster of Hetton House. Blaze stammered out his story. A good friend of his had died. He thought Coslaw was to blame. Johnny shouldn't have been sent out to pick pumpkins, especially not when it was cold. Johnny had a weak heart. It wasn't fair, and Mr. Coslaw knew it wasn't fair. He had it coming. At that, the young lawyer sat down with a look of despair in his eyes. The prosecutor rose and approached. He asked how tall Blaze was. 6'6", or maybe 7", Blaze said. The prosecutor asked how much he weighed. Blaze said he didn't know exactly, but not 300. This caused some laughter among the press. Blaze stared out at them with puzzled eyes. Then he smiled a little, too, wanting them to know he could take a joke as well as the next one. The prosecutor had no more questions. He sat down. Blaze's court-appointed made a furious, obscure summary, then rested his case. The judge looked out a window with his chin propped on one hand. The prosecutor then rose. He called Blaze a young thug. He said it was the state of Maine's responsibility to snub him up fast and hard. Blaze had no idea what that meant, but he knew it wasn't good. The judge asked Blaze if he had anything to say. "Yes, sir," Blaze said, "but I don't know how." The judge nodded and sentenced him to 2 years in South Portland Correctional. It wasn't as bad for him as it was for some, but bad enough so he never wanted to go back again. He was big enough to avoid the beatings and the buggery, and he walked outside all the underground cliques with their tin pot leaders, but being locked up for long periods of time in a tiny barred cell was very hard, very sad. Twice in the first 6 months, he went stir, howling to be let out and banging on the bars of his cell until the guards came running. The first time, 4 guards responded, then had to call in first another 4, and then a full half dozen to subdue him. The second time, they gave him a hypo that knocked him out for 16 hours. Solitary was worse still. Blaze paced the tiny cell endlessly, 6 steps each way, while time faltered and then stopped. When the door was finally open and he was let back into the society of the other boys, free to walk the exercise yard or pitch bundles off the trucks that came into the loading dock, he was nearly mad with relief and gratitude. He hugged the jailer who let him out on the second occasion and gained this note in his jacket: "Shows homosexual tendencies." But solitary wasn't the worst thing. He was forgetful, but the memory of the worst thing never left him. That was how they got you. They took you to a little white room and gathered around you in a circle. Then they began asking questions. And before you had time to think what the first question meant, what it said, they were on to the next, and the next, and the next. They backtracked, sidetracked, went up track and down. It was like being caught in a spider web. In the end, you would admit anything they asked you to admit, just to shut them up. Then they brought you a paper and told you to sign your name to it, and brother, you signed. The man in charge of Blaze's interrogation had been an assistant district attorney named Holloway. Holloway didn't come into the little room until the others had been going at him for at least an hour and a half. Blaze had his sleeves rolled up and the bottom of his shirt had come untucked. He was covered with sweat and needed to go number two bathroom, bad. It was like being in the Bowie's dog pen again, with the collie snapping all around him. Holloway was cool and natty in a blue pinstriped suit. He had on black shoes with galaxies of tiny holes in the fronts. Blaze never forgot the holes in the fronts of Mr. Holloway's shoes. Mr. Holloway sat on the table in the middle of the room, his ass half on and half off, one of his legs swinging back and forth, one of those elegant black shoes moving like the pendulum in a clock. He gave Blaze a friendly grin and said, "Want to talk, son?" Blaze began to stammer. Yes, he did want to talk. If someone really wanted to listen and be a little bit friendly, he did. Holloway told the others to get out. Blaze asked if he could go to the bathroom. Holloway pointed across the room to a door Blaze hadn't even noticed and said, "What are you waiting for?" He was wearing that same friendly grin when he said it. When Blaze came out, there was a pitcher of ice water and an empty glass on the table. Blaze looked at Holloway, and Holloway nodded. Blaze drank three glasses in a row, then sat back with what felt like an ice pick planted in the center of his forehead. "Good?" Holloway asked. Blaze nodded. "Yeah, answering questions is thirsty work. Cigarette?" "Don't use them." "Good, kid. That'll never get you in trouble," Holloway said, and lit one for himself. "Who are you to your pals, son? What do they call you?"
"Blaze."
"Okay, Blaze. I'm Frank Holloway." He stuck out his hand, then winced, and clamped the end of his cigarette with his teeth as Blaze wrung it. "Now tell me exactly what you did to wind up here." Blaze began to pour out his story, beginning with the law's arrival at Hetton and Blaze's problems with arithmetic. Holloway held up his hand. "Mind if I get a stenographer in on this, Blaze? That's a kind of secretary. Save you repeating all this." No, he didn't mind. Later, at the end, the others came back in. When they did, Blaze noticed that Holloway's eyes had lost their friendly glint. He slipped off the table, dusted his ass with two brisk whacks, and said, "Type it up and have the dummy sign it." He left without looking back. He left prison not quite 2 years after entering it. He got 4 months off for good behavior. They gave him two pairs of prison jeans, a prison denim jacket, and a hold-all to carry them in. He also had his prison savings, a check for $43.84. It was October. The air was flushed sweet with wind. The gate guard waved one hand back and forth like a windshield wiper and told him to stay clean. Blaze walked past without looking or speaking, and when he heard the heavy green gate thud shut behind him, he shivered. He walked until the sidewalks ended and the town disappeared. He looked at everything. Cars whipped past, looking strangely updated. One slowed, and he thought maybe he would be offered a ride. Then someone shouted, "Hey, jailbird!" and the car scooted away. At last, he sat down on the rock wall surrounding a little country graveyard and just looked down the road. It came to him that he was free, that he had no one to boss him, but he was bad at bossing himself and had no friends. He was out of solitary but had no job. He didn't even know how to turn the piece of stiff paper they'd given him into money. Still, a wonderful, soothing gratitude stole over him. He closed his eyes and turned his face up to the sun, filling his head with red light. He smelled the grass and fresh asphalt where some road crew had recently fixed a pothole. He smelled exhaust from cars that went wherever their drivers wanted to go. He clutched himself with relief. He slept in a barn that night, and the next day got a job picking taters for a dime a basket. That winter he worked in a New Hampshire woolen mill, strictly non-union. In the spring he took a bus to Boston and got a job in the laundry of the Brigham and Women's Hospital. He had been working there 6 months when a familiar face from South Portland turned up. Billy St. Pierre. They went out and bought each other many beers. Billy confided to Blaze that he and a friend were going to hold up a liquor store in Southie. The place was a tit. He said there was room for one more. Blaze was up for it. His cut was $17. He went on working at the laundry. 4 months later, he and Billy, and Billy's brother-in-law Dom, knocked over a combination gas station and grocery store in Danvers. A month after that, Blaze and Billy, plus another South Portland alum named Calvin Sirks, knocked over a loan agency with a betting room in the back. They took over $1,000. "We're hitting a big time now," Billy said, as the three of them split the swag in a Duxbury motel room. "This is just the start." Blaze nodded, but went on working in the hospital laundry. For a while, life rolled like that. Blaze had no real friends in Boston. His only acquaintances were Billy St. Pierre and the loosely orbiting crew of small-timers of which Billy was a member. Blaze took to hanging out with them during his off-hours in a Lynn candy store called Moochie's. They played pinball and horsed around. Blaze had no girl, steady or otherwise. He was painfully shy and self-conscious about what Billy called his busted head. After they did a successful job, he sometimes bought a whore. About a year after Blaze fell in with Billy, a fast-talking, part-time musician introduced him to heroin, a skin pop. It made Blaze violently sick, either from some additive or a natural allergy. He never tried it again. He would sometimes take a few tokes on a reef or fry daddy just to be sociable, but he had no use for harder drugs. Not long after the heroin experiment, Billy and Calvin, whose proudest possession was a tattoo reading, "Life Sirks, Then You Die," were busted trying to heist a supermarket. There were others willing to take Blaze on their current gags, however. Eager, even. Someone nicknamed him the Boogeyman, and it stuck. Even with a mask to hide his disfigured forehead, his immense size made any clerk or storekeeper think twice about grabbing the piece he might have under the counter. In the 2 years after Billy fell, Blaze just missed going down himself half a dozen times, some of those by the narrowest of margins. On one occasion, two brothers with whom he had heisted a clothing store in Saugus were grabbed just around the corner from where Blaze said thanks and got out of their car. The brothers would have been glad to give Blaze up in order to earn a break, but they only knew him as the Big Boogie, thus giving the police the idea that the third member of the gang had been African-American. In June, Blaze was laid off at the laundry. He didn't even bother looking for another straight job. He simply drifted through the days, until he met George Rackley, and when he met George, his future was set. Chapter 21. Albert Sterling was dozing in one of the overstuffed chairs in the Girard study when the first hints of dawn crept into the sky. It was February 1st. There was a knock on the side of the door. Sterling's eyes opened. Granger was standing there.
"We might have something," Granger said.
"Tell me."
"Blaisdell grew up in an orphanage. Well, state home, same difference. Called Hetton House. It's in the area his call came from."
Sterling got up. "Is it still operating?"
"Nope, closed 15 years ago."
"Who lives there now?"
"Nobody. The town sold it to some people who tried to run a day school out of it. Place went broke and the town took it back. It's been vacant ever since."
"I bet that's where he is," Sterling said. It was just intuition, but it felt true. They were going to nail the bastard this morning, and anyone who was running with him.
"Call the state police. I want 20 troopers, 20 at least, plus you and me."
He thought.
"And Franklin. Get Franklin out of the office." "He'll be in bed, actually."
"Get him out, and tell Norman to get his ass over here. He can mind the phone."
"You're sure that's how you want it?"
"Yes. Blaisdell's a crook. He's an idiot, and he's lazy."
That crooks were lazy was an article of faith in Albert Sterling's private church of beliefs. Where else would he go? He looked at his watch. It was 5:45. I just hope the kid's still alive. But I'm not betting on it. Blaze woke up at 6:15. He turned on his side to look at Joe, who had slept the night with him. The extra body warmth seemed to have done the little guy some good. His skin was cool, and the bronchial sound of his breathing had diminished. Those hectic red spots were still on his cheeks, though. Blaze put a finger in the baby's mouth. Joe began to suck at once, and felt a new swelling in the left gum. When he pressed down, Joe moaned in his sleep and pulled his face away. "Damn teeth," Blaze whispered. He looked at Joe's forehead. The wound had clotted, and he didn't think it would leave a scar. That was good. Your forehead led the charge through life. It was a lousy place to have a scar. His inspection was finished, but still he looked into the baby's sleeping face, fascinated. Except for the jagged, healing scratch, Joe's skin was perfect. White, but with glowing olive undertones. Blaze thought he would never burn in the sun, but tanned the color of nice old wood. He'll get so dark, some people will take him for a black guy, maybe, Blaze thought. He won't get all lobster red like me. Joe's lids were a faint but discernible blue. That same blue made a pair of tiny arcs beneath his closed eyes. The lips were rosy and slightly pursed. Blaze picked up one of the hands and held it. The fingers curled instantly over his pinky. Blaze thought they were going to be big hands. They might someday hold a carpenter's hammer or a mechanic's wrench, even an artist's brush. The dawning of the child's possibilities made him shiver. He felt an urge to snatch the baby up. And why? So he could watch Joe's eyes open and look at him. Who knew what those eyes might see in the years ahead? Yet now they were closed. Joe was closed. He was like a wonderful, terrible book where a story had been written in invisible ink. Blaze realized he didn't care about the money anymore, not really. What he cared about was seeing what words would appear on all those pages. What pictures. He kissed the clean skin just above the scrape, then threw back his blankets and went to the window. It was still snowing. Air and earth were white on white. He figured there must have been 8 inches come down in the night, and it wasn't done yet. "They've almost got you, Blaze." He whirled around. "George?" he called softly. "That you, George?" It wasn't. That had come from his own head. And why in the name of God would he have a thought like that? He looked out the window again. His mutilated brow drew down in thought. They knew who he was. He had been stupid and given that operator his real name, right down to the junior on the end. He had thought he was being smart, but he was being stupid. Again. Stupid was a prison they never let you out of. No time off for good behavior. You were in for life. George would have given him the old horse laugh for sure. George would have said, "I bet they went right to work digging up your records. Clayton Blaisdell's greatest hits." It was true. They'd read about the religious con, his stay in South Portland, his time at HH. And then, like a meteor streaking across his troubled consciousness, this was HH. Blaze looked around wildly, as if to verify this. "They've almost got you, Blaze." He began to feel hunted again, trapped in a narrowing circle. He thought of the white interrogation room, of having to go to the bathroom, of having questions thrown at you that they didn't even give you time to answer. And this time it wouldn't be a little trial in a half-empty courtroom. This time it would be a circus with every seat full. Then prison forever. And solitary confinement if he went stir. These thoughts filled him with terror, but they were far from the worst. The worst was thinking of them bursting in with their guns drawn and taking the baby back. Kidnapping him again. His Joe.
Sweat sprang up on his face and arms, in spite of the room's chill.
You poor sucker. He'll grow up hating your guts. They'll see to that.
That wasn't George either. That was his thought, and it was true. He began to rack his brains furiously, trying to make a plan. There ought to be a place to go. There had to be. Joe began to stir awake, but Blaze didn't even hear him. A place to go. A safe place, someplace close by. A secret place where they couldn't find him. A place that even George wouldn't know about. A place... Inspiration burst upon him. He whirled to the bed. Joe's eyes were open. When he saw Blaze, he gave him a grin and stuck his thumb in his mouth, a gesture that was almost jaunty.
Gotta eat, Joe. Quick. We're on the run, but I got an idea.
He fed Joe strained beef and cheese. Joe had been woofing down a full jar of this stuff at a go, but this time he started turning his head aside after the fifth spoonful. And when Blaze tried to force the issue, he began to cry. Blaze switched to one of the bottles, and Joe sucked at it greedily. Trouble was, there were only three left. While Joe lay on the blanket with the bottle clasped in his starfish hands, Blaze raced around the room, picking up and packing up. He broke open a package of Pampers and stuffed his shirt with them until he puffed out like the circus fat man. Then he knelt and began to dress Joe as warmly as he could. Two shirts, two pairs of pants, a sweater, his tiny knitted hat. Joe screamed indignantly all through this tribulation. Blaze took no notice. When the baby was dressed, he folded his two blankets into a small thick pouch and slipped Joe inside. The baby's face was now purple with rage. His screams echoed up and down the decaying hallway when Blaze carried him from the headmaster's office to the stairs. At the foot of the stairs, he put his own cap on Joe's head, taking care to cock it to the left. It covered him down to the shoulders. Then he stepped out into the driving snow. Blaze crossed the backyard and clambered awkwardly over the cement wall at its far end. The land on the other side had once been the Victory Garden. There was nothing here now but scrub bushes, only rounded humps beneath the snow, and scraggly young pines that were growing with no rhyme or reason. He jogged with the baby pulled tightly to his chest. Joe wasn't crying now, but Blaze could feel his short, quick gasps for breath as he struggled with the 10-degree air. At the far end of the Victory Garden was another wall, this one of piled rock. Many of the stones had fallen out of it, leaving big gaps. Blaze crossed at one of these and descended the steep grade on the other side in a series of skidding leaps. His heels drove up clouds of powdery snow. At the bottom, woods took over again, but a fire had burned through here 35 or 40 years before, a bad one. The trees and underbrush had grown back helter-skelter, fighting each other for space and light. There were blowdowns everywhere. Many were concealed by the snow, and Blaze had to slow down in spite of his need to hurry. The wind howled in the treetops. He could hear the trunks groaning and protesting. Joe began to whimper. It was a guttural, out-of-breath sound.
"It's all right," Blaze said. "We're getting there."
He wasn't sure the old barbed wire fence would still be there, but it was. It was drifted in right to the top, though, and he almost stumbled over it, plunging both himself and the baby into the snow. He stepped over instead, carefully, and walked down a deepening cleft of ground. The soil parted here, and the land's skeleton showed. The snow was thinner. The wind was now howling over their heads.
"Here," Blaze said. "Here's someplace."
He began to hunt back and forth about halfway to where the ground leveled off again, peering at jumbles of rocks, half-exposed roots, snow pockets, and caches of old pine needles. He couldn't find it. Panic began to rise in his throat. The cold would be seeping through the blankets now and through Joe's layers of clothes. "Farther down, maybe." He began to descend again, then slipped and fell on his rump, still clutching the baby to his chest. There was a sharp flare of pain in his right ankle, as if someone had struck sparks inside his flesh.
and he found himself staring at a triangular patch of shadow between two rounded rocks that bulged toward each other like breasts. He crawled toward it, still holding Joe against him. Yes, that was it. Yes, and yes, and yes. He ducked his head and crawled inside. The cave was dark and moist and surprisingly warm. The floor was covered with soft ancient pine boughs. Blaze was swept with deja vu. He and John Chelsman had dragged the boughs in after stumbling on this place by accident on a forbidden afternoon away from HH. Blaze set the baby down on a bed of boughs, fumbled in his jacket pocket for the kitchen matches he always kept in there, and lit one. By its wavering light, he could see Johnny's neatly made printing on the wall. Johnny C. and Clay Blaisdell, August 15th, third year of hell. It was written in candle smoke. Blaze shivered, not from the cold, not in here, and shook out the match. Joe was staring up at him in the gloom. He was gasping. His eyes were full of dismay. Then he stopped gasping.
"Christ, what's wrong with you?" Blaze cried.
The rock walls knocked his voice back into his own ears.
"What's wrong? What's—"
Then he knew. The blankets were too tight. He had pulled them around Joe when he put him down, and he'd pulled too hard. Kid couldn't breathe. He loosened them with trembling fingers. Joe whooped in a huge lungful of damp cave air and began to cry. It was a weak, trembling sound. Blaze shook the Pampers out of his shirt, then got one of the bottles. He tried to give Joe the nipple, but Joe turned his head away.
"Wait then," Blaze said. "Just wait."
He took his cap, put it on, gave it a tug to the left, and went out. He got some deadwood from a tangle at the end of the gulch and several handfuls of duff from beneath it. These he stuffed in his pocket. When he got back to the cave, he made a little fire and lit it. There was a small fissure like a cleft palate above the main opening, enough to create a draft and pull most of the smoke outside. He didn't have to worry about anyone seeing this little bit of smoke, at least not until the wind died and the snow stopped. He fed the fire stick by stick until it was crackling briskly. Then he put Joe on his lap before it and warmed him. The little guy was breathing more naturally now, but that bronchial rattle was still there.
"Gonna take you to a doctor," Blaze told him. "Soon as we get out of this. He'll fix you up. You'll be as cool as a fool."
Joe grinned at him abruptly, showing off his new tooth. Blaze grinned back, relieved. The kid couldn't be too bad off if he was still grinning, right? He offered Joe a finger. Joe wrapped his hand around it.
"Shake, pard," Blaze said, and laughed.
Then he took the cold bottle out of his jacket pocket, brushed off the clinging bits of duff, and set it next to the fire to get warm. Outside, the wind howled and shrieked, but in here it was warming up nicely. He wished he had remembered the cave first. It would have been better than HH. It had been wrong to bring Joe to an orphanage. It was what George would have called bad mojo.
"Well," Blaze said, "you won't remember, will you?"
When the bottle felt warm to the touch, he gave it to Joe. This time the baby latched on eagerly and took the whole thing. While putting away the last 2 ounces, his eyes took on the glassy, faraway look Blaze had come to know well. He put Joe on his shoulder and rocked him back and forth. The baby burped twice and talked his little nonsense words for maybe 5 minutes. Then he ceased. His eyes were closed again. Blaze was getting used to his schedule. Joe would sleep now for 45 minutes, maybe an hour, and then want to be active the rest of the morning. Blaze dreaded leaving him, especially after the accident of the night before. But it was vital. His instincts told him so. He laid Joe down on one of the blankets and put the other over him and anchored the top blanket with big rocks. He thought, hoped, that if Joe awoke while he was gone, he could turn over but not crawl out. It would have to be good enough. Blaze backed out of the cave, then started back the way he'd come, following his tracks. They were already starting to drift in. He hurried, and when the ground opened out, he began to run. It was 7:15 in the morning. While Blaze prepared to feed the baby, Sterling was in the Arrest and Recovery Operations Command Vehicle, a 4x4. He sat in the shotgun seat. A state trooper was driving. With his big flat hat off, the statey looked like a Marine recruit after his first haircut. To Sterling, most stateys look like Marine recruits, and most FBI agents look like lawyers or accountants, which was perfectly fitting, since... He caught his flying thoughts and pulled them back down to ground level.
"Can't you push this thing a little faster?"
"Sure," the statey said. "Then we can spend the rest of the morning picking our teeth out of a snowbank."
"There's no need to take that tone, is there?"
"This weather makes me nervous," the statey said. "This is a shitstorm, slippery as hell underneath."
"All right."
Sterling looked at his watch. "How far to Cumberland?"
15 miles.
"How long?"
The trooper shrugged.
25 minutes? Sterling grunted. This was a cooperative venture between the Bureau and the Maine State Police, and the only thing he hated more than cooperative ventures were root canals. The possibility of clusterfucks grew when you brought in state law enforcement. Of course, it jumped to a probability when the Bureau was forced into the dreaded cooperative venture with local law enforcement, but this was bad enough. Running point with a fake Marine who was afraid to push it past 50. He shifted in the seat, and the butt of his pistol dug into the small of his back. But it was where he always wore it. Sterling trusted his gun, his Bureau, and his nose. He had a nose like a good bird dog. A good bird dog could do more than smell a partridge or a turkey in the bushes. A good bird dog could smell its fear, and which way its fear would cause it to break. And when. It knew when the bird's need to fly was going to overmaster its need to stay still in its hide. Blaisdell was in a hide, probably this defunct orphan home. That was all very well, but Blaisdell was going to break. Sterling's nose told him so. And although the asshole had no wings, he had legs, and he could run. Sterling was also becoming sure that Blaisdell was in it alone. If there was someone else, the brains of the operation Sterling and Granger had taken for granted at first, they would have heard from him by now, if for no other reason than that Blaisdell was dumb as a stump. No, he was probably in it alone, and probably hunkered down in that old orphanage, like a half-assed homing pigeon, Sterling thought, certain no one would look for him there. No reason to believe they wouldn't find him squatting like a scared quail behind a bush. Except Blaisdell had his wind up. Sterling knew it. He looked at his watch. It was just past 6:30. The net would drop over a triangular area, along Route 9 to the west, a secondary road called Loon Cut on the north, and an old logging road to the southeast. When everyone was in position, the net would begin to close, collapsing on Hetton House. The snow was a pain in the ass now, but it would give them cover when they moved in. It sounded good, but... "Can't you roll this thing a little faster?" Sterling asked. He knew it was wrong to ask, wrong to push the guy, but he couldn't help it. The trooper looked at the man sitting beside him, at Sterling's small, pinched face and hot eyes, and he thought, "This type A fuck means to kill him, I think."
"Fasten your seatbelt, Agent Sterling," he said.
"It is," Sterling said. He thumbed it out like a vest. The statey sighed and stepped down a little harder on the gas. Sterling gave the order at 7 a.m., and the assembled forces moved in. The snow was very deep, 4 feet in places, but the men floundered and came on, staying in radio contact with each other. No one complained. A child's life was at stake. The falling snow gave everything a heightened, surreal urgency. They looked like figures in an old silent movie, a sepia melodrama, where there was no doubt about who the villain was. Sterling ran the operation like a good quarterback, staying on top of things by walkie-talkie. The men coming from the east had the easiest going, so he slowed them down to keep them in sync with those coming from the SR-9 and down Loon Hill from Loon Cut. Sterling wanted Hettenhouse surrounded, but he wanted more. He wanted every bush and grove of trees beaten for his bird on the way in.
"Sterling, this is Tanner. You copy?"
"Gotcha, Tanner. Come back."
"We're at the head of the road leading to the orphanage. Chain's still across the road, but the lock's been busted. He's up there all right. Over."
"It's a 10-4, Sterling said.
Excitement raced along his nerves in all directions. In spite of the cold, he felt sweat break in his crotch and armpits.
"Do you see fresh tire tracks? Come back."
"No, sir. Over."
"Carry on. Over and out."
They had him. Sterling's big fear had been that Blaisdell had beaten them again, driven out with the baby, and beaten them again. But no. He spoke softly into the walkie, and the men moved faster, panting their way through the snow like dogs. Blaze clambered over the wall between the Victory Garden and H.H.'s backyard. He ran to the door. His mind was in a frightful clamor. His nerves felt like bare feet on broken glass. George's words echoed in his brain, coming at him over and over.
"They've almost got you, Blaze."
He ran up the stairs in mad leaps, skidded into the office and began to load everything, clothes, food, bottles, into the cradle. Then he thundered back down the stairs and sprinted outside. It was 7:30. 7:30.
"Hold it," Sterling said quietly into his walkie-talkie. "Everybody just hold it for a minute. Granger? Bruce? Copy?"
The voice that came back sounded apologetic.
"This is Corliss."
"Corliss? I don't want you, Corliss. I want Bruce. Over."
"Agent Granger's down, sir. Think he broke his leg. Over."
"What?"
"These woods are lousy with deadfalls, sir. He, stumbled into one and it gave way. What should we do? Over."
Time slipping away. Vision in his mind of a great big hourglass filled with snow and Blaisdell slipping through the waste. On a fucking sled.
"Splint it up and wrap him up warm and leave him your walkie. Over."
"Yes, sir."
"Do you want to talk to him? Over."
"No, I want to move. Over."
"Yes, sir, I'm clear."
"Fine," Sterling said.
"All you group leaders, let's hump. Out."
Blaze ran across the Victory Garden, gasping. He reached the ruined rock wall at the far end, climbed over, and skidded willy-nilly down the slope into the woods, clutching the cradle to his chest. He got up, started to step forward, then stopped. He set the cradle down and pulled George's gun out of his belt. He had seen nothing and heard nothing, but he knew. He moved behind the trunk of a big old pine. Snow whipped against his left cheek, numbing it. He waited without moving. Inside his mind was a fury. The need to get back to Joe was an ache, but the need to stand here and wait and be quiet was just as strong. What if Joe got out of the blankets and crawled into the fire? "He won't," Blaze told himself. "Even babies are as scared of fire." What if he crawled out of the cave into the snow? What if he was freezing to death right now as Blaze stood here like a lump? "He won't. He's asleep." Yes, and no guarantee how long he'll stay that way in a strange place. Or what if the wind shifts around and the cave fills up with smoke while you stand here, the only living person in 2 miles, maybe 5? He wasn't the only one. Someone was around. Someone. But the woods were silent except for the wind, the creaking trees, and the faint hiss of falling snow. Time to go. Only it wasn't. It was time to wait.
"You should have killed a kid when I told you, Blaze."
George, in his head now, Christ!
"I wasn't ever nowhere else. Now go!"
He decided he would. Then he decided he would count to 10 first. He had gotten up to 6 when something detached itself from the gray-green belt of trees farther down the slope. It was a state policeman, but Blaze felt no fear. Something had burned it away, and he was deadly calm. Only Joe mattered now, taking care of Joe. He thought the trooper would miss him, but the trooper wouldn't miss the tracks, and that was just as bad. Blaze saw that the trooper would pass his position on the right, so he slipped around the trunk of the big pine tree to the left. He thought of how many times he and John and Toe and the others had played in these woods. Cowboys and Indians, cops and robbers. Bang, with a crooked piece of stick and you're dead. One shot would end it. It didn't have to kill, or even wound either of them. The sound would be enough. Blaze felt a pulse thudding in his neck. The trooper paused. He'd seen the tracks, must have. Or a piece of Blaze's coat peeking around the tree. Blaze flicked the safety off George's pistol. If there was going to be a shot, he wanted it to be his. Then the trooper moved on again. He glanced down at the snow from time to time, but he directed most of his attention into the thickets. 50 yards away now. No. Less. Off to the left, Blaze heard someone else crash through a deadfall or some low branches and utter a curse. His heart sank even deeper in his chest. The woods were full of them then, but maybe if they were all going in the same direction. Hetton. They were surrounding Hetton House, sure. And if he could get back to the cave, he'd be on the other side of them. Then farther into the woods, maybe 3 miles, there was a logging road. The trooper had closed to 25 yards. Blaze sidled a little farther around the tree. If someone popped out of the brush on his open side now, he was dead dog fucked. The trooper was passing the tree. Blaze could hear the crunch of his boots in the snow. He could even hear something jingling in the trooper's pockets. Change, maybe keys, and the creak of his belt. That, too. Blaze moved even farther around the tree, taking little sidle steps. Then he waited. When he looked out again, the trooper had his back to Blaze. He hadn't seen the tracks yet, but he would. He was walking on top of them. Blaze stepped out and walked toward the trooper in large, soundless steps. He reversed George's pistol so he was gripping it by the barrel. The trooper looked down and saw the tracks. He stiffened, then grabbed for the walkie-talkie on his belt. Blaze raised the gun up high and brought it down hard. The trooper grunted and staggered, but his big hat absorbed much of the blow's force. Blaze swung again, sidehand, and hit the trooper in the left temple. There was a soft thud. The trooper's hat slewed around to the side and hung on his right cheek. Blaze saw he was young, hardly more than a kid. Then the trooper's knees unlocked and he went down, puffing up snow all around him. "Fucks," Blaze said. He was crying. "Why can't you just leave a fella alone?" He gripped the trooper under the armpits and dragged him to the big pine. He propped the guy up and set his hat back on his head. There wasn't much blood, but Blaze wasn't fooled by that. He knew how hard he could hit. No one knew better. There was a pulse in the trooper's neck, but it wasn't much. If his buddies didn't find him soon, he would die. Well, who had asked him to come? Who had asked him to stick his goddamn oar in? He picked up the cradle and began to move on. It was 7:45 when he got back to the cave. Joe was still sleeping, and that made Blaze cry again, this time from relief. But the cave was cold. Snow had blown in and put the little fire out. Blaze began to build it up again. Special Agent Bruce Granger watched Blaze come down the ravine and crawl into the slit mouth of the cave. Granger had been lying there stolidly, waiting for the hunt to end one way or another so someone could carry him out. His leg hurt like hell, and he'd felt like a fool. Now he felt like someone who'd won the lottery. He reached for the walkie Corliss had left him and picked it up. "Granger to Sterling," he said quietly. "Come back." Static. Peculiar blank static. "Albert, this is Bruce, and it's urgent.
Come on back. Nothing. Granger closed his eyes for a moment. Son of a bitch, he said. Then he opened his eyes and began to crawl. 8:10. Albert Sterling and two state troopers stood in Martin Koslaw's old office with their guns drawn. There was a blanket squashed up in one corner. Sterling saw two empty plastic nursing bottles and three empty cans of carnation evaporated milk that looked like they had been opened with a jackknife blade, and two empty boxes of Pampers. Shit, he said. Shit, shit, shit. He can't be far, Franklin said. He's on foot with the kid. It's 10 degrees out there, someone in the hall remarked. Sterling thought, one of you guys tell me something I don't fucking know. Franklin was looking around. Where's Corliss? Brad, did you see Corliss? I think he might be downstairs, Bradley said. We're going back into the woods, Sterling said. The moke's gotta be in the woods. Then there was a gunshot. It was faint, muffled by the snow, but unmistakable. They looked at each other. There were 5 seconds of perfect, shocked silence. Maybe 7. Then they broke for the door. Joe was still asleep when the bullet came into the cave. It ricocheted twice, sounding like an angry bee, chipping away splinters of granite and sending them flying. Blaze had been laying out diapers. He wanted to give Joe a change, make sure he was dry before they set out. Now Joe started awake and began to cry. His small hands were waving in the air. One of the granite chips had cut his face. Blaze didn't think. He saw the blood and thought ceased. What replaced it was black and murderous. He burst from the cave and charged toward the sound of the shot, screaming. Chapter 22 Blaze was sitting at the counter in Moochie's, eating a donut and reading a Spider-Man funny book when George walked into his life. It was September. Blaze hadn't worked for 2 months and money was tight. Several of the candy store wise guys had been pinched. Blaze himself had been taken in for questioning about a loan office holdup in Saugus, but he hadn't been in on that job and had come across so honestly bewildered that the cops let him go. Blaze was thinking about trying to get back his old job at the hospital laundry. That's him, someone said. That's the boogeyman. Blaze turned and saw Hanky Melcher. Standing with him was a little guy in a sharp suit. The little guy had sallow skin and eyes that seemed to burn like coals. Hi, Hank, Blaze said. Ain't seen you. Nah, a little state vacation, Hank said. They let me out 'cause they can't count right up there. Ain't that so, George? The little guy said nothing, only smiled thinly and went on looking at Blaze. Those hot eyes made Blaze uncomfortable. Moochie walked down, wiping his hands on his apron.
Yo, Hanky.
Chocolate egg cream for me, Hank said. Want one, George?
Just coffee. Black.
Moochie went away. Hank said,
Blaze, I'd like you to meet my brother-in-law. George Rackley, Clay Blaisdell.
Hi, Blaze said. This smelled like work.
Yo.
George shook his head.
Your one big mother, know it?
Blaze laughed as if no one had ever observed he was one big mother before.
George is a card, Hank said, grinning. He's a regular Bill Crosby, only white.
Sure, Blaze said, still smiling. Moochie came back with Hanky's egg cream and George's coffee. George took a sip, grimaced. He looked at Moochie.
Do you always shit in your coffee cups, or do you sometimes use the pot, sunshine?
Hank said to Moochie, George don't mean nothing by it. George was nodding.
That's right, I'm just a card, that's all. Get lost a little while, Hanky. Go in the back and play pinball.
Hanky was still grinning. Yeah, okay. Righty-o. When he was gone, and Moochie was back down at the far end of the counter, George turned to Blaze again.
That retard says you might be looking for work.
That's about right, Blaze said. Hanky dropped coins into the pinball machine, then raised his hands and began to vocalize what might have been the theme from Rocky. George jerked his head at him.
Now that he's out again, Hanky's got big plans. A gas station in Malden.
That so? Blaze asked.
Yeah, crime of the fucking century. You want to make $100 this afternoon?
Sure.
Blaze answered without hesitation.
Will you do exactly what I tell you?
Sure. What's the gag, Mr. Rackley?
George. Call me George.
What's the gag, George?
Then he reconsidered the hot, urgent eyes and said, I don't hurt nobody.
Me either. Bang bangs for mokes. Now listen.
That afternoon, George and Blaze walked into Hardee's, a thriving department store in Lynn. All the clerks in Hardee's wore pink shirts with white arms. They also wore badges that said, Hi, I'm Dave, or John, or whoever. George was wearing one of those shirts under his outside shirt. His badge said, Hi, I'm Frank. When Blaze saw that, he nodded and said, That's like an alias, right? George smiled, not the one he'd used around Hanky Melcher, and said, Yes, Blaze. Like an alias. Something in that smile made Blaze relax. There was no hurt or mean in it. And since it was just the two of them on this gag, there was no one to nudge George in the ribs when Blaze said something dumb and make him the outsider. Blaze wasn't sure George would have grinned even if there had been someone else. He might have said something like, Keep your fucking elbows to yourself, shit monkey. Blaze found himself liking someone for the first time since John Cheltzman died. George had hoed his own tough road through life. He had been born in the charity ward of a Providence Catholic hospital called St. Joseph's, mother unwed, father unknown. She resisted the nun's suggestions that she give the boy up for adoption and used him as a club to beat her family with instead. George grew up on the patched pants side of town, and pulled his first con at the age of 4. His mother was about to give him a whacking for spilling a bowl of Mapo. George told her a man had brought her a letter and left it in the hall. While she was looking for it, he locked her out of the apartment and booked it down the fire escape. His whacking later was double, but he never forgot the exhilaration of knowing he had won, at least for a little while. He would chase that I gotcha feeling the rest of his life. It was ephemeral, but always sweet. He was a bright and bitter boy. Experience taught him things that losers like Hanky Melcher would never learn. George and 3 older acquaintances, he did not have pals, stole a car when George was 11, took a joyride from Providence to Central Falls, got pinched. The 15-year-old, who had been behind the wheel, went to the reformatory. George and the other boys got probation. George also got a monster whacking from the gray-faced pimp his mother was by then living with. This was Aidan O'Kelleher, who had notoriously bad kidneys, hence his street name, Pisser Kelly. Pisser beat on him until George's half-sister screamed for him to stop. "You want some?" Pisser asked, and when Tansy shook her head, he said, "Then shut your fucking air scoop." George never stole another car without a reason. Once was enough to teach him there was no percentage in joyriding. It was a joyless world. At 13, he and a friend got caught boosting in Woolworths. Probation again. And another whacking. George didn't stop boosting, but improved his technique and wasn't caught again. When George was 17, Pisser got him a job running numbers. At this time, Providence was enjoying the sort of half-assed revival that passed for prosperity in the economically exhausted New England states. Numbers were going good. So was George. He bought nice clothes. He also began to jiggle his book. Pisser thought George a fine, enterprising boy. He was bringing in $650 every Wednesday. Unknown to his stepfather, George was socking away another $200. Then the mob came north from Atlantic City. They took over the numbers.
some of the mid-level locals got pink-slipped. Pisser Kelly was pink-slipped to an automobile graveyard, where he was discovered with his throat cut and his balls in the glove compartment of a Chevrolet Biscayne. With his living taken away, George set off for Boston. He took his 12-year-old sister with him. Tansy's father was also unknown, but George had his suspicions. Pisser had had the same weak chin. During the next 7 years, George refined any number of short cons. He also invented a few. His mother listlessly signed a paper making him Tansy Rackley's legal guardian, and George kept the little whore in school. Came a day when he discovered she was skin-popping heroin. She was also, happy days, knocked up. Hanky Melcher was eager to marry her. George was surprised at first, then wasn't. The world was full of fools falling all over themselves to show you how smart they were. George took to Blaze because Blaze was a fool with no pretensions. He wasn't a Sharpie, a dude, or a backroom Clyde. He didn't shoot pool, let alone H. Blaze was a rube. He was a tool, and in their years together, George used him that way. But never badly. Like a good carpenter, George loved good tools. Ones that work like they were supposed to every time. He could turn his back on Blaze. He could go to sleep in a room where Blaze was awake, and know that when he woke up himself, the swag would still be under the bed. Blaze also calmed George's starved and angry insides. That was no small thing. There came a day when George understood that if he said,
"Blazer, you have to step off the top of this building because it's how we roll."
Well, Blaze would do it. In a way, Blaze was the Cadillac George would never have. He had big springs when the road was rough. When they entered Hardee's, Blaze went directly to menswear as instructed. He wasn't carrying his own wallet. He was carrying a cheap plastic job which contained $15 cash and ID tabbing him as David Billings of Reading. As he entered the department, he stuck his hand in his back pocket, as if to check his wallet was still there, and pulled it three-quarters of the way out. When he bent over to check out some shirts on a low shelf, the wallet fell on the floor. This was the most delicate part of the operation. Blaze half-turned, keeping an eye on the wallet without seeming to keep an eye on it. To the casual observer, he would have seemed entirely engrossed in his inspection of the Van Heusen short sleeves. George had laid it out for him carefully. If an honest man noticed the wallet, then all bets were off, and they would move on to Kmart. Sometimes it took as many as half a dozen stops before the gag paid off.
"Gee," Blaze said, "I didn't know so many people were honest." "They're not," George said with a wintry smile. "But plenty are scared. And keep your eye on that fucking wallet. If someone dips it on you, you're out $15 and I'm out ID worth a lot more."
That day in Hardee's, they had beginner's luck. A man wearing a shirt with an alligator on the tit strolled up the aisle, spied the wallet, then looked both ways down the aisle to see if anyone was coming. No one was. Blaze exchanged one shirt for another, and then held it up in front of him in the mirror. His heart was pumping like a sweet mother.
"Wait until he pockets it," George said. "Then raise holy hell."
The man in the alligator shirt hooked the wallet against the rack of sweaters he was looking at. Then he reached into his pocket, took out his car keys, and dropped them on the floor.
"Oops."
He bent down to get them, and gleeped the wallet at the same time. He shoved them both into his front pants pocket, then started to stroll off. Blaze let out a bull bellow.
"Thief! Thief! Yeah, you!"
Shoppers turned and craned their necks. Clerks looked around. The floorwalker spotted the source of the trouble and began to hurry toward them, pausing at a cash register location to push a button labeled "Special." The man with the alligator on his tit went pale. Looked around, bolted. He got four steps before Blaze collared him.
"Rough him up, but don't hurt him," George had said. "Keep hollering, and whatever you do, don't let him ditch that wallet.
If he looks like he's trying to get rid of it, knee him in the jukebox.
Blaze grabbed the man by the shoulders and began shaking him up and down like a man with a bottle of medicine. The man in the alligator shirt, maybe a Walt Whitman fan, voiced his barbaric yawp. Change flew from his pockets. He stuck a hand in the pocket with a wallet in it, just as George had said he might, and Blaze popped him one in the nuts, not too hard. The man in the alligator shirt screamed.
"I'll teach you to steal my wallet," Blaze screamed at the guy's face.
He was getting into it now.
"I'll kill you." "Somebody get him off me," the guy screamed. "Get him off."
One of the menswear clerks poked his nose in. "Hey, that's enough." George, who had been examining casual wear, unbuttoned his outer shirt, took it off with absolutely no effort at concealment, and stashed it under a stack of beefy tees. No one was looking at him anyway. They were looking at Blaze, who gave a mighty tug and tore the shirt with the alligator on the tit right down the middle.
"Break it up," the clerk was shouting. "Cool it." "Son of a bitch has got my wallet," Blaze cried.
A large crowd of rubberneckers began to gather. They wanted to see if Blaze would kill the guy he had hold of before the floorwalker or store detective or some other person in authority arrived. George punched no sale on one of the two menswear department cash registers and began scooping out the currency. His pants were too large, and a pouch, sort of like a hidden fanny pack, was sewn in the front. He stuffed the bills in there, taking his time. Tens and twenties first. There were even some fifties, beginner's luck indeed, then fives and ones.
"Break it up,"
the floorwalker was yelling as he cut through the crowd. Hardy's did have a store detective, and he followed on the floorwalker's heels.
"That's enough. Hold it."
The store detective shoved himself between Blaze and the man in the torn alligator shirt.
"Stop fighting when the store dick comes," George had said, "but keep making like you want to kill the guy."
"Check his pocket," Blaze yelled. "Son of a bitch, dip me."
"I picked a wallet up off the floor," the alligator man admitted, "and was just glancing around for the possible owner when this thug..."
Blaze lunged at him. The alligator man cringed away. The store dick pushed Blaze back. Blaze didn't mind. He was having fun.
"Easy, big fella. Down, boy."
The floorwalker, meanwhile, asked the alligator man for his name.
"Peter Hogan."
"Dump out your pockets, Mr. Hogan."
"I certainly will not."
The store dick said,
"Dump them out or I'll call the cops."
George strolled toward the escalator, looking as alert and lively as the best Hardee's employee who ever punched a time clock. Peter Hogan considered whether or not to stand on his rights, then dumped out his pockets. When the crowd saw the cheap brown wallet, it went, "Ah."
"That's it," Blaze said. "That's mine. He must have took it out of my back pocket while I was looking at shirts."
"ID in it?" the store dick asked, flipping open the wallet. For a horrible moment, Blaze went blank. Then it seemed like George was standing right there beside him.
"David Billings, Blaze."
"Sure, Dave Billings," Blaze said. "Me."
"How much cash in it?"
"Not much, $15 or so."
The store dick looked at the floorwalker and nodded. The crowd awed again. The store dick handed the wallet to Blaze, who pocketed it.
"You come with me," the store dick said.
He grabbed Hogan's arm.
The floorwalker said, "Break it up, folks. This is all over. Hardee's is full of bargains this week, and I urge you to shop them."
Blaze thought he sounded as good as a radio announcer. It was no wonder he had such a responsible job. To Blaze, the floorwalker said,
"Will you come with me, sir?"
"Yeah."
Blaze glared at Hogan. "Just let me get the shirt I wanted."
"I think you'll find that your shirt is a gift from Hardee's today. But we would like to see you briefly on the third floor. Ask for Mr. Flaherty, room 7.
Blaze nodded and turned to the shirts again. The floorwalker left. Not far away, one of the clerks was getting ready to punch no sale on the register George had robbed.
"Hey, you," Blaze said to him, then beckoned.
The clerk came over, but not too close.
"May I help you, sir? This joint got a lunch counter?"
The clerk looked relieved.
"First floor."
"You the man," Blaze said. He made a gun of his right thumb and forefinger, tipped the clerk a wink, and strolled off toward the escalator. The clerk watched him go. By the time he got back to his register, where all the bill compartments in the tray were now empty, Blaze was out on the street. George was waiting in a rusty old Ford. And off they drove. They scored $340. George split it right down the middle. Blaze was ecstatic. It was the easiest job he had ever done. George was a mastermind. They would pull the gag all over town. George took all this with the modesty of a third-rate magician who had just run the jacks at a children's birthday party. He didn't tell Blaze the gimmick went back to his grammar school days when two buckies would start a fight by the meat counter and a third would scoop the till while the owner was breaking it up. Nor did he tell Blaze they would be collared the third time they tried it, if not the second. He simply nodded and shrugged and enjoyed the big guy's amazement. Amazement? Blaze was fucking awestruck. They drove into Boston, stopped at a liquor store, and picked up 2/5 of Old Granddad. Then they went to a double feature at the Constitution on Washington Street and watched car chases and men with automatic weapons. When they left at 10 o'clock that evening, they were both blotto. All 4 hubcaps had been stolen off the Ford. George was mad, even though the hubcaps had been as shitty as the rest of the car. Then he saw someone had also keyed off his Vote Democrat bumper sticker and started to laugh. He sat down on the curb, laughing until tears rolled down his sallow cheeks.
"Taken off by a Reagan lover," he said. "My fucking word.
Maybe the guy who spoiled your fumper liquor wasn't the same guy who took your wheel caps," Blaze said, sitting down beside George.
His head was whirling, but it was a good whirl, a nice whirl.
"Fumper liquor," George cried.
He bent over as if he had a stomach cramp, but he was screaming with laughter. He tromped his feet up and down.
"I always knew there was a word for Barry Goldwater. Fucking fumper liquor."
Then he stopped laughing. He looked at Blaze with swimming, solemn eyes and said,
"Blazer, I just pissed myself."
Blaze began to laugh. He laughed until he fell back on the sidewalk. He had never laughed so hard, not even with John Cheltzman. 2 years later, George was busted for passing bad checks. Blaze's luck was in again. He was getting over the flu, and George was alone when the cops grabbed him outside of a Danvers bar. He got 3 years, a stiff sentence for first-time forgery. But George was a known bunco, and the judge was a known hard-ass, perhaps even a fumperlicker. It was 20 months with time served and time off for good behavior. Before the sentencing, George took Blaze aside.
"I'm going to Walpole, big boy. A year at least, probably longer."
"But your lawyer—"
"The fuckhead couldn't defend a pope on a rape charge. Listen, you stay away from Moochies."
"But Hank said if I came around, he could—"
"And stay away from Hanky, too. Get a straight job until I come out. That's how you roll. Don't go trying to pull any cons on your own. You're too goddamn dumb. You know that, don't you?"
"Yeah,"
Blaze said, and grinned. But he felt like crying. George saw it and punched Blaze on the arm.
"You'll be fine," he said.
Then, as Blaze left, George called to him. Blaze turned. George made an impatient gesture at his forehead. Blaze nodded and swerved the bill of his cap around to the good luck side. He grinned. But inside, he still felt like crying. He tried his old job, but it was too square after life with George. He quit and looked for something better. For a while, he was a bouncer at a place in the combat zone, but he was no good at it.
His heart was too soft. He went back to Maine, got a job cutting pulp, and waited for George to get out. He liked pulping, and he liked driving Christmas trees south. He liked the fresh air and horizons that were unbroken by tall buildings. The city was okay sometimes, but the woods were quiet. There were birds, and sometimes you saw deer wading in ponds and your heart went out to them. He sure didn't miss the subways or the pushing crowds. But when George dropped him a short note, "Getting out on Friday. Hope to see you," Blaze put in his time and went south to Boston again. George had picked up an assortment of new cons in Walpole. They tried them out like old ladies test-driving new cars. The most successful was the queer con. That bastard ran like a railroad for 3 years, until Blaze was busted on what George called the Jesus gag. George picked something else up in prison, the idea of one big score and out. Because, he told Blaze, he couldn't see spending the best years of his life hustling homos in bars where everybody was dressed up like the Rocky Horror Picture Show, or peddling fake encyclopedias, or running a Murphy. Now, one big score and out, it became his mantra. A high school teacher named John Burgess, in for manslaughter, had suggested kidnapping.
"You're tripping," George said, horrified.
They were in the yard on 10 o'clock exercise, eating bananas and watching some mokes with big muscles throw a football around. "It's got a bad name because it's the crime of choice for idiots," Burgess said. He was a slight balding man. "Kidnap a baby, that's the ticket."
"Yeah, like Hauptmann," George said, and jittered back and forth like he was getting electrocuted.
Hauptmann was an idiot. Hell, Rasp, a well-handled baby snatch could hardly miss. What's the kid gonna say when they ask him who did it? "Goo goo gaga," he laughed.
"Yeah, but the heat," George said.
"Sure, sure, the heat." Burgess smiled and tugged his ear. He was a great old ear tugger. There would be heat. Baby snatches and cop killings, always a lot of heat. You know what Harry Truman said about that? "No." He said if you can't stand the heat, get out of the kitchen.
"You can't collect a ransom," George said. "Even if you did, the money would be marked. Goes without saying."
Burgess raised one finger like a professor. Then he did that dopey ear-tugging thing, which kind of spoiled it. "You're assuming the cops would be called in. If you scared the family bad enough, they'd deal privately." He paused. "And even if the money was hot, you saying you don't know some guys?"
"Maybe. Maybe not.
There are guys who buy hot money. It's just another investment to them, like gold or government bonds."
"But collecting the swag, what about that?"
Burgess shrugged. He pulled on his ear. "Easy. Have the marks, drop it from a plane." Then he got up and walked away. Blaze was sentenced to 4 years on the Jesus gag. George told him it would be a tit if he kept his nose clean. 2 at most, he said, and 2 was what it turned out to be. Those years inside weren't much different than the jail time he'd put in after beating up the law, only the inmates had grown older. He didn't spend any time in solitary. When he got the heebie-jeebies on long evenings, or during one interminable lockdown when there were no exercise privileges, he wrote George. His spelling was awful, the letters long. George didn't answer very often. But in time, the very act of composition, laborious as it was, became soothing. He imagined that when he wrote, George was standing behind him, reading over his shoulder.
"Prison laundra," George would say. "My fucking word."
"That wrong, George?"
"P-R-I-S-O-N. Prison. L-A-U-N. D-R-Y. Laundry. Prison laundry."
"Oh, yeah, right." His spelling and even his punctuation improved, even though he never used the dictionary. Another time,
"Blaze, you're not using your cigarette ration."
This was during the golden time when some of the tobacco companies gave out little trial packs.
I don't hardly smoke, George. You know that. They just pile up.
Listen to me, Blazer. You pick 'em up on Friday, then sell 'em the next Thursday when everybody's hurting for a smoke. That's how you roll.
Blaze began to do this. He was surprised how much people would pay for smoke that didn't even get you stoned. Another time,
"You don't sound good, George," Blaze said.
"Course not. I just had 4 fucking teeth out. Hurts like hell."
Blaze called him the next time he had phone privileges, not reversing the charges, but feeding the phone with dough he'd made selling ciggies on the black market. He asked George how his teeth were.
"What teeth?" George said grumpily. "Fucking dentist is probably wearing them around his neck like a Ubangi."
He paused.
"How'd you know I had him out? Someone tell you?"
Blaze suddenly felt he was on the verge of being caught in something shameful, like beating off in chapel.
"Yeah," he said. "Someone told me."
They drifted south to New York City when Blaze got out, but neither of them liked it. George had his pocket picked, which he took as a personal affront. They took a trip to Florida and spent a miserable month in Tampa, broke and unable to score. They went north again, not to Boston, but to Portland. George said he wanted to summer in Maine and pretend he was a rich Republican fuckstick. Not long after they arrived, George read a newspaper story about the Girards, how rich they were, how the youngest Girard had just gotten married to some good-looking spick chick. Burgess's kidnap idea resurfaced in his mind, that one big score. But there was no baby, not then. So they went back to Boston. The Boston in the winter, Portland in the summer thing became a routine over the next 2 years. They'd roll north in some old beater in early June with whatever remained of the winter's proceeds stashed in the spare tire. 700 one year, 2,000 the next. In Portland, they pulled a gag if a gag presented itself. Otherwise, Blaze fished and sometimes laid a trap or two in the woods. They were happy summers for him. George lay out in the sun and tried to get a tan. Hopeless, he only burned. Read the papers, swatted black flies, and rooted for Ronald Reagan, who he called Old White Elvis Daddy, to drop dead. Then on July 4th of their second summer in Maine, he noticed that Joe Girard III and his Narmenian wife had become parents. Blaze was playing solitaire on the porch of the shack and listening to the radio. George turned it off.
"Listen, Blazer," he said, "I got an idea."
He was dead 3 months later. They had been attending the crap game regularly, and there had never been any trouble. It was a straight game. Blaze didn't play, but he often faded George. George was very lucky. On this night in October, George made 6 straight passes. The man kneeling across from him on the other side of the blanket bet against them every time. He had lost $40. The game was in a warehouse near the docks, and it was full of smells, old fish, fermented grain, salt, gasoline. When the place was quiet, you could hear the tack, tack, tack of seagulls walking around on the roof. The man who had lost $40 was named Ryder. He claimed to be half Penobscot Indian, and he looked it. When George picked up the dice a 7th time instead of passing them, Ryder threw $20 down on the crap outline.
"Come, dice," George said, crooned.
His thin face was bright. His cap was yanked around to the left.
"Come, big dice, come now."
The dice exploded across the blanket and came up 11.
"7 in a row," George crowed. "Pick up that swag, Blazerino. Daddy's going for number 8. Big 8er from Decatur."
"You cheated," Ryder said.
His voice was mild, observational. George froze in the act of picking up the dice.
"Say what?"
"You switched them dice."
"Come on, Ryde," someone said. "He didn't—"
"I'll have my money back," Ryder said.
He stretched his hand out across the blanket.
You'll have a broken arm if you don't cut the shit, George said. That's what you'll have, Sunshine.
I'll have my money back, Ryder said, his hand still out. It was one of those quiet times now, and Blaze could hear the gulls on the roof, tack, tack, tack.
Go fuck yourself, George said, and spat on the outstretched hand.
So then it happened quickly, as those things do. The quickness is what makes the mind reel and refuse. Ryder reached his spit-shiny hand into the pocket of his jeans, and when it came out, it was holding a spring knife. Ryder thumbed the chrome button in the imitation ivory handle, and the men around the blanket scattered back. George shouted, "Blaze!" Blaze lunged across the blanket at Ryder, who rocked forward on his knees and put the blade in George's stomach. George screamed. Blaze grabbed Ryder and slammed his head against the floor. It made a cracking sound like a breaking branch. George stood up. He looked at the knife handle sticking out of his shirt. He grabbed it, started to pull, then grimaced.
Fuck, he said. Oh, fuck.
He sat down hard. Blaze heard a door slam. He heard running feet on hollow boards.
Get me out of here, George said.
His yellow shirt was turning red around the knife handle.
Get the swag, too. Oh, Jesus, this hurts.
Blaze gathered up the scattered bills. He stuffed them into his pockets with fingers that had no feeling in them. George was panting. He sounded like a dog on a hot day.
George, let me pull it out.
No, you crazy. It's holding my guts in. Carry me, Blaze. Oh, my fucking Jesus.
Blaze picked George up in his arms, and George screamed again. Blood dripped onto the blanket and onto Ryder's shiny black hair. Under the shirt, George's belly felt as hard as a board. Blaze carried him across the warehouse and then outside.
No, George said. You forgot the bread. You never got any goddamn bread.
Blaze thought maybe George was talking about the swag, and he started to say he had it when George said,
"And the salami."
He was beginning to breathe very rapidly.
I got that book, you know.
George!
That book with the picture of...
And then George began to choke on his own blood. Blaze turned him over and whammed him on the back. It was all he could think of to do. But when he turned George over again, George was dead. Blaze laid him on the boards outside the warehouse. He backed away. Then he crept forward again and closed George's eyes. He backed away a second time, then crept forward again and knelt.
George?
No answer.
You dead, George?
No answer. Blaze ran all the way to the car and got in and threw himself behind the wheel. He screamed away, peeling rubber for 20 feet.
Slow down, George said from the back seat.
George?
Slow down, goddammit.
Blaze slowed down.
George! Come on up front, climb over. Wait, I'll pull over.
No, George said. I like it back here.
George?
What?
What are we gonna do now?
Snatch the kid, George said. Just like we planned.
Chapter 23. When Blaze blundered out of the little cave and got his feet under him, he had no idea how many men were out there. Dozens, he supposed. It didn't matter. George's pistol fell out of the waistband of his pants, and that didn't matter either. He trod in deep into the snow as he charged the first guy he saw. The guy was lying in the snow a little distance away, resting on his elbows and holding a gun in both hands.
Hands up, Blaisdell. Stay still, Granger shouted.
Blaze leaped at him. Granger had time to fire twice. The first shot creased Blaze's forearm. The second plugged nothing but snowstorm. Then Blaze crashed all 270 pounds into the guy who had hurt Joe, and Granger's weapon went flying. Granger screamed as the bones of his broken leg grated together.
You hit the kid,
Blaze yelled into Granger's terrified face. His fingers found Granger's throat.
You hit the kid, you stupid son of a bitch! You hit the kid! You hit the kid! You hit the kid!
Granger's head was flopping and nodding now, as if to say he understood, he was getting the message. His face had gone purple, his eyes bulged from their sockets.
"They're coming."
Blaze stopped choking the guy and looked around. No one in sight. The woods were silent, except for the wind and the faint hissing noise the snow made as it fell. No, there was another sound. There was Joe. Blaze ran back up the embankment to the cave. Joe was rolling around, wailing and clutching at the air. The flying chip of rock had done more damage than the fall from the cradle. His cheek was covered in blood. "God damn it!" Blaze cried. He picked Joe up, wiped his cheek, slipped him into the envelope of blankets again, and stuck his cap back over the baby's head. Joe whooped and screamed. "We gotta run now, George," Blaze said. "Full out run, right?" No answer. Blaze backed out of the cave holding the baby to his chest, turned into the wind, and fled toward the logging road.
"Where did Corliss leave him?" Sterling panted at Franklin. The men had paused at the edge of the woods, breathing hard. Franklin pointed.
"Down there. I can find it."
Sterling turned to Bradley.
"Call your people, and the Cumberland County Sheriff. I wanted that logging road plugged at both ends. What's past it if he slips through?"
Bradley barked a laugh.
"Nothing but the Royal River. Like to see him ford that. Is it iced over?"
"Sure, but not enough to walk on."
"All right, let's press on. Franklin, take point. Short point. This guy is very dangerous."
They moved down the first slope. 50 yards into the woods, Sterling made out a blue-gray figure slumped against a tree. Franklin got there first.
"Corliss," he said.
"Dead?"
Sterling asked, joining him.
"Oh, yeah."
Franklin pointed to tracks that were now little more than vague dips.
"Let's go," Sterling said. This time he took point.
They found Granger 5 minutes later. The marks on his throat were at least an inch deep.
"Guy must be a brute," someone said.
Sterling pointed into the snow.
"That's a cave up there, I'm almost positive. Maybe he left the kid."
Two state troopers scrambled up toward the triangular patch of shadow. One of them paused, bent, picked something out of the snow. He held it up.
"A gun!" he yelled.
"As if the rest of us are blind," Sterling thought.
"Never mind the friggin' gun. See about the kid, and be careful."
One of them knelt, used his flashlight, then crawled through the beam. The other bent forward, hands on knees, listened, then turned back to Sterling and Franklin.
"Not here!"
They spotted tracks leading from the cave toward the logging road even before the trooper who had gone into the cave was out again. They were little more than vague humps in the fast-falling snow.
"He can't have more than 10 minutes on us," Sterling said to Franklin.
Then he raised his voice.
"Spread out! We're gonna sweep him out onto that road!"
They headed out fast, Sterling tromping in Blaze's tracks. Blaze ran. He went in stumbling leaps, crashing straight through tangles of brush rather than trying to find a way around, bending over Joe to try and shield him from stabbing branches. Breath tore in and out of his lungs. He heard faint yelling behind him. The sound of those voices filled Blaze with panic. Joe was whooping and struggling and coughing, but Blaze held him fast. Just a little more, a little farther, and they would come out on the road. There would be cars there, police cars, but he didn't care about that. As long as there were keys left in them, he would drive as far and fast as he could, then dump the police cruiser and switch to something else. A truck would be good. These thoughts came and went in his head like big colored cartoons. He blundered through a marshy place, where the thin ice surrounding the snow-covered hummocks gave way and plunged him into frigid water up to his ankles. He kept going and came to a head-high wall of brambles. He went straight through, only turned around backwards to protect Joe. One of them got under the cap Joe was wearing, though, and slingshotted it back toward the marsh. No time to get it. Joe stared around, his eyes wide with terror. Without the enveloping hat to warm the air in front of his face, he began to gasp harder. Now his cries sounded thin. Behind them, the faint blue voice of the law was yelling something else. It didn't matter.
Nothing did, except getting to the road. The land began to slope upward. The going became a little easier. Blaze lengthened his stride, running for his life, and Joe's. Sterling was also going full out, and he had drawn 30 yards ahead of the others. He was gaining. Why not? The big bastard was breaking trail for him. The walkie on his belt crackled. Sterling pulled it, but didn't waste his breath, only double-keyed it.
"This is Bradley. Come back?"
"Yeah." That was all. Sterling needed the rest of his breath to run with. The most coherent thought in his mind, overlaying the others like a bright red film, was the knowledge that the homicidal fuck had killed Granger, had killed an agent.
"County Sheriff has placed units on that logging road, boss. State police will reinforce ASAP. Over."
"Good. Over and out." He ran on. 5 minutes later, he came upon a red cap lying in the snow. Sterling stuck it in his coat pocket and kept running. Blaze struggled the last 50 uphill yards to the logging road, almost winded. Joe wasn't crying anymore. He no longer had breath to waste on crying. Snow had clotted on his eyelids and in his lashes, weighting them down. Blaze went to his knees twice, each time holding his arms against his sides to cushion the baby. At last he reached the top, and bingo, there were at least 5 empty state police cruisers parked up and down the road. Below him, Albert Sterling broke from the woods and looked up the incline Blaze had already climbed, and damn, there he was. There the big bastard finally was.
"Stop, Blaisdell, FBI. Stop and put your hands up."
Blaze looked over his shoulder. The cop looked tiny from up here. Blaze turned back and ran out into the road. He stopped at the first cruiser and looked in. Once again, bingo, keys dangling from the ignition. He was about to put Joe on the seat beside the officer's citation book when he heard an engine revving. He turned and saw a white cruiser slewing up the road toward him. He turned the other way and saw another one.
"George!" he screamed. "Oh, George!"
He clutched Joe against him. The baby's respiration was very fast and shallow now, the way George's had been after Ryder stabbed him. Blaze slammed the state police car's door and ran around the hood. A Cumberland County Sheriff's deputy leaned from the car that was coming from the north. He had a battery-powered bullhorn in one gloved hand.
"Stop! Blaisdell, it's over. Stay where you are."
Blaze ran across the road and someone fired at him. Snow puffed up on his left. Joe began to let out a series of gasping whimpers. Blaze plunged down the other side of the road, taking gigantic leaps. Another bullet droned past his head, snapping splinters and bark from the side of a birch tree. At the bottom, he stumbled over a log hidden beneath the fresh snow. He went down into a drift, the baby beneath him. He struggled to his feet and brushed Joe's face off. It was powdered with snow.
"Joe, you all right?"
Joe was breathing in hoarse, convulsive gasps. Each one seemed to come an age apart. Blaze ran. Sterling got to the road and ran across it. One of the county sheriff's cars had come to a skidding, veering stop on the far side. The deputies were out and standing there, looking down, guns pointing. Sterling's cheeks were stretched and his gums were cold, so he supposed he was grinning.
"We got the bastard!"
They ran down the embankment. Blaze dodged through a skeletal stand of poplar and ash. On the other side, everything opened up. The trees and underbrush were gone. There was a flat, white stillness in front of him, and that was the river. On the far side, gray-green masses of spruce and pine marched toward a snow-choked horizon. Blaze began to walk out onto the ice. He got 9 steps before the ice broke, plunging him in frigid water up to his thighs. Struggling for breath, he lurched back to the bank and climbed it. Sterling and the 2 deputies burst through the last clump of trees.
"FBI," Sterling said. "Lay the baby down on the snow and step back."
Blaze turned to the right and began to run. His breath was hot and hard, going down his throat now. He looked for a bird, any bird, over the river, and saw none. What he saw was George. George was standing 80 yards or so ahead. He was mostly obscured by blowing snow, but Blaze could see his cap, slewed around to the left, the good luck side.
"Come on, Blaze. Come on, you fucking slowpoke. Show 'em your heels. Show 'em how we roll, goddammit."
Blaze ran faster. The first bullet took him in the right calf. They were firing low to protect the baby. It didn't slow him down. He didn't even feel it. The second hit the back of his knee and blew his kneecap out in a spray of blood and bone fragments. Blaze didn't feel it. He kept running. Sterling would say later he never would have thought it possible, but the bastard just kept running like a gut-shot moose.
"Help me, George! I'm in trouble!"
George was gone, but Blaze could hear his hoarse, raspy voice. It came to him on the wind.
"Yeah, but you're almost out of it. Shag, baby."
Blaze let out the last notch. He was gaining on them. He was getting his second win. He and Joe were going to get away after all. It had been a close shave, but it was all going to turn out okay. He looked at the river, straining his eyes, trying to see George or a bird, just one bird. The third bullet struck him in the right buttock, angled up, shattered his hip. The slug also shattered. The largest piece hung a left and tore open his large intestine. Blaze staggered, almost fell, then took off running again. Sterling was down on one knee with his gun in both hands. He sighted quickly, almost offhandedly. The trick was not to let yourself think too much. You had to trust your hand-eye coordination and let it do its work.
"Jesus, work your will," he said.
The fourth bullet, Sterling's first, struck Blaze in the lower back, severing his spinal cord. It felt like being punched by a big hand in a boxing glove, just above the kidneys. He went down, and Joe flew from his arms.
"Joe!"
he cried, and began to haul himself forward on his elbows. Joe's eyes were open. He was looking at him.
"He's going for the kid," one of the deputies yelled.
Blaze reached for Joe with one large hand. Joe's own hand, searching for anything, met it. The tiny fingers wrapped around Blaze's thumb. Sterling stood behind Blaze, panting. He spoke low so the deputies couldn't hear him. "This is for Bruce, sweetheart."
"George?"
Blaze said. And then Sterling pulled the trigger. Chapter 24. Excerpt from a news conference held February 10th. Question. "How's Joe, Mr. Gerard?" Gerard. "The doctors say he's going to be fine, thank God. It was touch and go there for a while, but the pneumonia's gone now. He's a fighter, no doubt about that." Question. "Any comments about the way the FBI handled the case?" Gerard. "You bet. They did a fine job." Question. "What are you and your wife going to do now?" Gerard. "We're going to Disneyland." Laughter. Question. "Seriously?" Gerard. "I almost was being serious. Once the doctors give Joey a clean bill, we're going on vacation. Somewhere warm, with beaches. Then when we're home, we're going to work at forgetting this nightmare." Blaze was buried in South Cumberland, less than 10 miles from Hetton House, and about the same distance from where his father threw him down a flight of apartment house stairs. Like most paupers in Maine, he was buried on the town. There was no sun that day, and no mourners, except for the birds, crows mostly. Near cemeteries in the country, there are always crows. They came, they sat in the branches, and then flew away to wherever birds go. Joe Gerard IV lay behind plate glass in a hospital crib. He was well again. His mother and father would be back this very day to take him home, but he didn't know it. He had a new tooth, and knew that. It hurt. He lay on his back and looked at the birds over his crib. They were on wires, and flew whenever a breath of air stirred them into motion. They weren't moving now, and Joe began to cry. A face bent over him, and a voice began cooing. It was the wrong face, and he began to cry louder. The face pursed its mouth and blew on the birds. The birds began to fly. Joe stopped crying. He watched the birds. The birds made him laugh. He forgot about wrong faces, and he forgot the pain of his new tooth. He watched the birds fly.
Blaze was written by Richard Bachman and read by Ron McLarty. The recording engineer was Erica Weintraub. Editing and post-production by Frog Pond Productions. Mixed by Hudson Sound. The associate producer was Michael Noble. Special thanks to Ellen Hurst. Blaze was produced and directed by Karen Perlman. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio.